Hello and welcome to the Reading Collective, a small but mighty reading club who love books and believe in the joy of sharing great stories with each other. I'm Jordy, your host, and today you're joining us for a very special installment of our new series, Heart to Heart, a Romance Author Series, where we sit down with romance and romantasy authors whose stories make our hearts race and our bookshelves overflow. Today's guest is a total dream, but before we dive into her latest book, Full Moon Rising, I want to take a moment to give her her flowers. I first discovered Ruby Dixon's books during the early days of the pandemic. Like so many of us, I was looking for an escape. Enter Ice Planet Barbarians. It was fun, heartfelt, and honestly addictive. The kind of story that wraps around your imagination that doesn't let go. I found joy in her world when the real one felt uncertain. And now I've pulled a few friends into the vortex and she's fully converted. They're all converted at this point. So Ruby, thank you truly for writing stories that give us light when we need it the most. Oh, now,
for like, having me. Oh, sorry.
No. You can jump in whenever. Now let's properly introduce today's guest. Ruby Dixon is a best-selling author celebrated for her blend of romance, fantasy, and sci-fi adventure. With a signature mix of steam, heart, and humor, she's best known for the widely popular Ice Planet Barbarian series. And her books have captured readers across genres and platforms from indie shelves to book talk fame. Her latest book, Bull Moon Rising, gives us everything we love. A smart, I gave my Boston accent popped out a little
bit. No, I'm just kidding. Smart beginning and ending. No, yeah. I'm just kidding.
A smart, capable heroine, a no-nonsense hero with secrets of his own, magical artifacts, swoon-worthy romance, and just the right amount of danger. It's a story about power, identity, and finding love in a world that doesn't always make space for it. Ruby, we're so excited to have you here. Welcome to the Reading Collective. Woo-hoo!
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, great. I think before we just started recording, we're talking about the weather. It sounds like you're in a really nice, warm environment. And I'm in a cooler environment for the fall.
Yes. I think that's one reason why Ice Planet Barbarians is such an escape for me sometimes, because Texas is always unpleasantly warm and sometimes just unpleasant. So it's nice to dream about a planet that's really cold all the time, because when we get snow here, it's one day and that's it. So.
And that's the day you go grab your Ice Planet Barbarian book and read it, so you're fully immersed.
That's right. That's right. take pictures. I'm like, research.
Oh, I was going to say, I'm also really feeling really good today, because I was on your website and I took the What's Your Royal Artifactual Guild name.
Yes.
And it came out that I'm Sparrow. So I was
Sparrow's a good one.
It's a good one. So I even took a photo just in case anyone doesn't have proof. Before we get into the questions, for anyone listening, I wanted to give you a quick synopsis of Bull Moon Rising. So in a world of magical artifacts and ancient ruins, Aspeth Honori, or Sparrow, the daughter of a noble, is desperate to save her family's hold, her family's legacy, and their lives. When the Royal Artifactual Guild refuses to train her because she's a woman, Aspeth makes a bold move. She proposes a marriage of convenience to Hawk, a surly, rule-bound minotaur who has problems of his own. Their arrangement, a marriage of convenience. Strictly business, of course. Not so much.
Yeah, it never stays that way.
Yeah. She gets guild access. He gets a wife. Things get steaming fast. Throwing Aspeth's hidden identity, magical politics, and a few unexpected feelings, and suddenly survival isn't just about saving her hold. It might mean protecting her heart too. No. Did I leave anything out?
No, that's good.
Yeah. Awesome. I thought perhaps we can start at the beginning, with our first question being, what was your first introduction to romance, either as a reader or a writer?
So I'm old. So when I was younger, I went to the library, and anything that was in paperback, I noticed, got cycled through more, lots more paperbacks than just the hardbacks. The hardbacks tended to be really old and musty looking. So I would gravitate towards the paperbacks, and I always noticed these really beautiful, painted covers, and they would have like a little hologram in the corner that was like a heart. And that was one particular romance line that was called like Zebra Romance. And I would just basically look for that hologram, and I read everything that the library had, and I would go to used bookstores and just look for the heart and just grab things. And I just read so many books, and I loved it. I loved it. Was like historical, because historical romance was really about the only thing that you could get back in the day. And it would just, it took you to another world. And it was also really great because the storyline was focused on the woman, and she would actually have a happy story or a happy ever after. Or she would be the hero in her own story. Whereas a lot of the time when you would read something, I came from like science fiction and fantasy, and a lot of the time the woman would just be there to motivate the man. And so I really loved having a female centric story. And I just kind of got addicted after that. It was never really a question for me if I was going to write romance. It was just, okay, if I'm writing, what kind of romance is it going to be? So.
Oh, that's awesome. Thank you for sharing that. I love how the you looked for the heart, and it was the heart was leading you to
yes.
And I agree with you as well. For me, it was also historical romances that really got me started in the romance genre. Like you said, that was what was plentiful at the time. And anytime someone thought about romance, it's always where the woman was the leading character. It's always like in historical fantasies, and in other fantasies, it's usually the male, and they're using that as a motivator. I agree, and I love that. I also thought for this book, it also reminded me of Indiana Jones a bit.
I grew up loving like Indiana Jones and The Mummy. Oh, love yes, The Mummy. And I looked for everything I could find that had like artifacts and like archaeology and like swashbuckling, and there was never a female heroine doing any of that. So I had to write it myself.
Yeah, of course.
There's a lot more now, though. Like Isabel Canas, I think is her last name, is like What the River Knows, is a young adult archaeological adventure sort of book. And those are really good. So, terrible remembering names.
There is so much now for young adults, and so many different authors writing really work, really robust work. I get jealous a bit because I've been reading mostly adult books, so I'm like, I would love to see more of this as well in the author's face. So it's a good time to be a reader, I think.
It is because you can choose from young adult and you can choose from adult, because I feel like a lot of the readership is the same. It's just, you know, the age range of the characters more than anything else.
For sure. Awesome. Okay, so now I thought we can start maybe talking a bit more about the book. So when I started reading the book early on, one thing that really stood out to me and I appreciated was Aspeth's insistence on wearing sensible shoes.
Yes.
Grabbing them before she leaves. And I related to that so much because, you know, I love a pair of sneakers and I get always wearing them. And I was just wondering, what's your go-to sensible shoe right now?
I really love a fancy pants shoe, but I honestly, since I work from home, I end up gravitating towards Skechers. I probably have like six different kinds of Skechers because I have like the foam. I like a Mary Jane. Mary Jane goes with everything. I really like, if I'm doing a fancier shoe, I like a brand called Fluvogs. And they're like stupid expensive, but like they're comfortable, so even if you get one with like a ridiculous heel, it's still comfortable. That being said, I'm not wearing anything with heels anymore. I'm wearing Crocs right now, pink Crocs. So
big fan of Crocs. Wear it all summer until I get like the Croc like tan on my feet, because that's all I'm ever wearing.
And I have some Lisa Frank ones waiting in the wings for when I wear these out. So
nice. Yeah, I think going a bit back to what you said about female characters being centered in like these fantasy books, especially like adventure ones, this makes me think about video games. Whenever like a female character is, they the clothes that they wear, even the shoes that they wear are not sensible sometimes. You're like, why is the male character all covered in armor and the female character is wearing like these high heels?
Tomb Raider. Like, the only thing people remember about Tomb Raider is how short her shorts were and how big her boobs were.
Yes.
That's all her. And I was like, yeah.
And her ponytail was so long. And I'm like, that is a hazard. Like, running, getting dangerous. So love that detail.
Like, I get that it's not supposed to be like super realistic, but can we be a little realistic? You're going through the jungle, maybe wear some long pants so you don't get bit by mosquitoes. So no, I'm just
asking for a few more pockets. Maybe a
that's
few
right.
More pockets.
That's right.
But okay. Love that. So on this topic of like, you know, being a woman, being centered in spaces, maybe where you're not, as a woman, I know that being like the only woman in the spaces carries a lot of weight. And there's this incredible moment in the book where Asbeth has this umbrella and she uses it to take up space in a very public male dominated arena.
Yes.
I love how something as simple as an umbrella can become like a statement for Asbeth to take up space. So I was wondering if you maybe can talk a bit more about that. Was that a deliberate choice on your part or was that like a happy accident that worked quite perfectly?
That was more of a happy accident. I knew that I wanted her to go in and be very serious about this job. She's here for this job. She is excited. She's read up on everything. She's learned all she can, and her not being taken seriously by men at all. And I think every woman can relate to going into a male-dominated space and men not treating you like an equal. I know when I was younger, I was a really big gamer. I played D&D, I played Magic the Gathering, I played all the stuff that was super nerdy back then and is more mainstream now. And I would a lot of the time be the only girl in the store. And if there was a tournament, I would be told like, oh, you must have just gotten like, you know, a good draw or whatever. Or guys would be like, oh, you know, you can come play with my group, you know, we'll show you how to play. And I'm like, what the fuck is that? I had when I was a teenager, guys would follow me around at conventions, not because I was hot, I would be wearing like Sunday school stuff, but because you're a girl and you're like the only girl, some neckbeard will follow you around. And it's uncomfortable and unpleasant, and it ruins the situation for you. And so I wanted to, I guess, show that in a book and show her like taking control of the situation, because so many times I have like frozen up and not done anything because you don't know what to do in a situation like that. It makes you uncomfortable. So in a fantasy, my character takes charge even if she's upset. So
I also love that she knows her smarts, her knowledge. She knows that she has something to contribute.
Yes.
She's going to contribute whether they want to or not. She will find a way to do that. And I think that's very important to be centered and know what value you bring.
And, absolutely. And she's never like, in her eyes, she is just, you know, she just has to figure out, okay, I'm a piece that needs to be in this guild. They say no, I just need to figure out how to make them say yes. And I don't think it comes until much later in the story that she realizes, oh, they're never going to take me seriously. And so then she kind of looks for an alternative finds her. But I did like that she had a very rose-colored glasses sort of view of things. Even when people were trying to ruin it for her, she was still devoted to the work more than, like, it was the people that were the problem, not the job itself.
Yeah, and I love that. And I love how you brought up the idea of these rose-colored glasses, because we have the next question touches a bit on that. So on the flip side of Asbeth is Magpie, and she's the only woman in the Artifactual Guild who has achieved professorship, essentially. But she isn't what Asbeth, who holds her as a hero, turns out to be. And I was rooting for her to turn things around. I was like, oh my goodness, what's going to happen? And I guess people will read and see what happens. But what I got from this was a strong theme of, you can say maybe a strong theme of disillusionment. I don't know if I said that right.
I think so. Yeah. I think Magpie was, if you let, like, I guess the world bring you down, this is one avenue that, it can take, or like, you know, if you let things affect you, oh, sorry, that was my messages. If you let things affect you, you know, you can either choose to be rose-colored glasses like Asbeth and be like, you know, I'm going to choose to see the positive. I'm going to choose to continue the work. Or you can be like, oh, no, everything is shit and let it all destroy you. And me as a person, I am definitely more rose-colored glasses. So I, throughout the story, I wanted Magpie to have a turnaround moment. Mm-hmm. And whether she does or not, I said, I think speaks a lot about her character. Mm-hmm. So, but that was fun to write, almost as a contrast to
foil.
Yes, Asbeth
for sure.
Yeah.
And I was curious: is there a world where we get to see Magpie again, or learn a bit more about who she is?
The sequel just came out by the Horns. It was in hardback in September, and she is not in it. So
interesting. So goodbye, yes. Magpie. It was great
for now. Yes.
Awesome. Thank you. And I appreciate the message that you just shared about choosing the way in which you see the world and how that impacts how you make choices and how you choose to wake up every day and either keep training like Asbeth or give up and go do something else.
Yes.
I, while also reading this, loved the humor in this. This is my kind of humor.
Thank you.
And I know we can maybe talk about it. Writing humor is really difficult. Or even just trying to connect with people through humor. But I loved Asbeth's humor and her, give my terrible pun, grab the bull by the horns attitude.
Yes.
Toward life and love and how all of that carried into her relationship with Hawk. How did you think about like how you shaped their dynamic, balancing Asbeth's boldness with Hawk's own strengths throughout the story?
I wanted her to be kind of naive, but also she is spoiled because she has lived in this sheltered hold all her life and she's always had money. And so she is not used to reality, the real world, like people telling her no. And so she assumes that a no is just a temporary no until it's a yes. Mm-hmm. And so I liked that mentality and I liked playing with that because he's been in the trenches. He's seen some shit. He had to work his way up from nothing. He knows what a hard day's work is like. Whereas like her, a hard day might be like, oh, I had to rearrange my library, you know? So they come from different circles. And I think he is more down to earth. And so that really played a lot of, how they played a lot off how they interplay with each other. I'm using the word play a million times. Sorry. But like, I wanted him to be more jaded. Like, you know, this is how the world really works. And she comes in and she's all Mary Poppins and like, no, everything's great. Mm-hmm. And the reality is somewhere in the middle for both of them. So it was fun to have them come together and play off of each other in a more positive way than say Asbeth and Magpie.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And what I liked about their relationship and dynamic is that it felt really like they were comfortable with just being really straight. I mean, beyond like, you know, certain secrets, very straight with one another and just really communicating on like on the same level. And that I think I really strengthened their relationship throughout. And she wasn't shy about who she was and what she can bring.
Yeah. I think she was definitely like, okay, I'm going to need to get out of my comfort zone to get what I want. Mm-hmm. Here's what I have to bargain. And like, she's the one propositioning him.
Right. Yeah.
Because she's like, I have something that I need. You can help me with that. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you're absolutely insane. And she's like, that doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. This can benefit both of us. And so it was a lot of fun for her to be the aggressor and still like have no idea what she's really getting into, because she really doesn't have an idea. And that was part of the fun. So
yeah, that was definitely fun for sure. Another fun thing about this world is that the magic system is built so that you have these artifacts that are imbued with magic. And some are for safety and defense. And then there's others for joy, like a dish that constantly refills itself with olives.
Yes.
So that had me thinking, if you could create a magical artifact that exists in this world, in our world, what would it be?
In this world, I would have like a magic like makeup mirror or something that would automatically just apply my makeup. Like, I'm not wearing it right now. My nose is bright red because of the sunlight. But like, everybody now is so good at makeup, like contouring and 7 different layers. And I am not, I can't even draw a straight line. So with my eye pencil. So I would like something to do my makeup for me and have it look freaking amazing. That would be my magic artifact.
No, I love that. I would love it to do my eyeliner. I'm not good at that. Like my wing, perfect wing. That would be really great.
Yes, I can't do the wing. I get like one eye that looks decent and the other one looks like, you know, shaky, palsied hand. Yes, it's terrible. So
and it quickly turns into like raccoon eyes because I just keep trying to fix it and it's not working.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, you can't. If it starts out bad, you just got to like clean the whole thing off and start over. Like you can't patch it. I've learned that.
Something like that. I definitely agree with the olives never running out bowl for sure, but yeah, something like that. And I think there was one about a necklace that gives you good vision on the coin.
Option.
And I was like, this is a good one too, because I can hardly see without my glasses. So I
can't either. Yeah. I have 2 different sets of glasses. Like I have some for if I'm on the computer for a long period of time, and then I have another pair. And then like they both still don't feel like they do enough. Like I feel like I need stronger pairs for both. But I had a lot of fun with the artifacts because I wanted it to be like the society that they came from was like a really rich, spoiled, like materialistic sort of world. And I wanted them to have like artifacts for the dumbest stuff, like, you know, cups that light up or whatever, or like, you know, a mirror that like when you walk past it, it smells like roses, or, you know, just dumb stuff that rich people like that isn't practical at all. And so I just imagine, like, what would that be like if, like, 1,000 years from now you dug that up? You'd be like, this is the stupidest waste of magic.
Yeah.
And yet it's still cool, you know? Like, I think one thing was, like, the painting where, like, if you hang it on the wall, it spies on people in the room for you.
Yeah.
I was like, well, it'd be so fun to have, you know? But it was just a lot of fun to imagine, like, what sort of useless but novelty magic items would they have. So, and then imagining like a black market almost for it, or the nobles are the only ones that can buy this stuff. And so it's like the rich getting richer all over again.
Yes. Yeah. And then there's this aspect of, you know, like, is it ethical to, you know, go to these places and try and get these artifacts and then sell it to the wealthy and like, you know, everybody else has nothing, and it's things like a mirror that smells like roses that we're like disturbing people's rest for.
They're literally grave robbing to get these artifacts and make money off of them. And that's one part of like Aspis naivete is that she doesn't think of it as grave robbing until like she actually has to go and pull something from a dead corpse. And you don't realize that aspect. That was when I was really obsessed with archaeology when I was younger. And I read an article and they were like digging up something that was like 200 years old. And I was like, is that really archaeology? I mean, like, if it's, because to me, archaeology is like 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago. And then I'm like, 200 years ago, like, you can still point to those people in your ancestor, you know, in your family tree. And I was like, you know, at what point does it become grave robbing? Like, at what point do we say, you know, it not enough time has passed? Like, and do these people want to be, nobody wants to be dug up after they're dead. You know, the ancient Egyptians, their whole culture was like the tomb has to remain undisturbed, the body has to remain undisturbed for this person to have a happy afterlife. And the first thing like the Victorian people would do is they would go and grab the mummies, and they would have mummy unwrapping parties, or they would eat mummy or sniff mummy because they thought it was like an aphrodisiac. And I'm like, you're like, if what they believed was true for them, you are destroying their afterlife. At what point is this like, you know, in the name of science or ethical? And so that was one thing I wanted to play with, just because I don't have an answer for that myself.
Right. That's a hard one to answer. And I also think about, like you said, you know, these artifacts or objects people dig up, and they spend a lot of time studying it and sometimes money doing all these tests. And sometimes it's just a bowl. It was just a bowl. And now he spent so much time trying to figure out if there's any hidden secrets, and you're going to spend that time and maybe money elsewhere.
Yeah, it's like, it's just some old scissors. Sorry.
that's it. Well, yeah, that is so cool. Our last question that we have is, so you're known for creating worlds that are fun, swoony, and addictive, but also deeply heartfelt. What keeps you inspired to keep writing stories like this? You have also so many books, which is great for like, the readers.
I love spending time with my characters. Like, I write a story that I want to write. And like, sometimes it's like, okay, somebody else has done this type of story. I want to do my spin on it and just have fun with it and see what I can do to those characters, or like answer a question, I guess, philosophically. That sounds like really highbrow, and it's not, but it's like, if I don't have an answer, I want characters to, you know, discuss it, and maybe I can come to like an inner peace about the situation. Like, if they don't have answers either, I don't know. I really worked through a lot of my love of like archaeology in the Royal Artifactual Guild, because I have always been like, okay, you know, is it, you know, cool? Is it not? Or like, I worked through gender issues in the workplace. So a lot of it is like, I want to play with this and see how it turns out on the page, or I want to see this represented in a book. Like, right now I am writing another fantasy, and the heroine is a 30-year-old woman that has scoliosis. And because I was looking for books on scoliosis, and the only books that I could find were like a couple of young adult books. And I grew up with scoliosis. I had my spine fused when I was 15, and it is not something that just disappears when you turn 18. It's something that affects you all through your life. And there were no books about it. And I was like, well, you know, I want to see that in a story, because it does affect how you perceive yourself and how others perceive you. Like, especially if like in a fantasy society where there is no spinal fusion surgery, like, what do you do? Are you the village hunchback? I mean, to be like, that's a terrible way of putting it, but I'm like, you know, a lot of people say like, oh, in a past life, I would have been like a princess or a baker. I would have been the village hunchback. So I want to put that in a story and see what happens. So I think a lot of it is like me wanting to play in my own sandbox and see what I can come up with and still give these people a happy ever after, because I do think there is a lid for every pot.
Oh yeah, for sure. And I think by writing these stories that are deeply personal to you, you unknowingly reach other people who, you know, might see themselves in those stories. And that example you just gave right now, that someone out there could, you know, have the same, you know, health condition and would love to see that. And I think it's also, I always also find it really interesting when people think about the past and they say, oh, I was like, you know, this hero or this queen or this king, but I think so more so it's just as important to have other people around that.
Nobody's ever the peasant. Everybody's Cleopatra or, you know, Anne Boleyn. Nobody is ever. Yeah, I was, you know.
Who's cooking the food? Who is doing anything?
Who's and doing the laundry?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's like the heart of, you know, any good society. And those people, it's really great to highlight them and see them also getting these happy ending stories in these really fun ways, for sure. So I'll keep my eye out on that.
That one won't be out till 2027. So I'm still reading it, but it's so much fun right now. So I'm really enjoying it. And I'm really enjoying that, like, she's another heroine that's like angry at the world around her. There's a trend.
There is a lot to be angry about. So,
right. That's right.
Good in there. but yeah, I love that. Like, I can't wait to see the different, that side of you in the book, and as you share a bit of yourself more.
Thank you.
Also, Ruby, thank you so much for joining us and for giving us Full Moon Rising, a story full of heart, heat, and heroine power. It's been such a joy getting to dig into the book with you. Before we wrap up, I know you just told us about what you're working on in the future, but I think I saw something on your website about a space vampire. Is that
the same one? Yes. So Space Vampire, Amazon reached out to me and they said, would you like to write a story for us? And I was like, yes.
Oh, how fun.
And they're like, we have Allie Hazelwood and Christina Lauren and Katie Robert. And I was like, say less. I will absolutely do this. Yeah. So they also got Kimberly Lemming, who I adore, love her books. Mm-hmm. Her story was super funny. And so they were like, well, we want to do Halloween stories. And I was like, can I do a vampire in space? And they're like, sure, that sounds great. So it's a kind of a standalone. It's set in the Ruby Dixon universe. So if you read Ice Planet Barbarians and you've read some of the spinoffs, you know, the basics of how my universe is set up, but these are brand new characters. So you don't have to be caught up on anything. It's a completely enclosed story, standalone. She is, everybody abandons a space station that's a research space station, and she is left behind because she's viewed as a pet. So when you evacuate, you leave your pet. And so she's like, well, this is a perfect time to escape. And she goes to escape only to realize that the reason why they evacuated is because there's a monster on the station. And she runs into the monster on the station, who is a space vampire. So... it's a short story. It's a fun story. It's free in Kindle Unlimited. It's already got audio. So if you listen to audio, you can download that one. And it was a lot of fun. And I was really happy to be included in such illustrious company. I was stoked about that. So.
Hooray. That sounds like fun. Definitely. I was like, space vampire.
Yes. Very on the nose. It's like, what could it be about? It's about a space vampire. I do like an on the nose title. Ice Planet Barbarians. It's like, you know what you're getting.
No, I love it. Like, I'm like, oh my God, I guess I'll just have to read it.
That's right. You should.
Awesome. Thank you. I'm really excited for what's coming next. To our listeners, if you love this conversation, we'd love for you to subscribe, follow us on Instagram at the_thereadingcollective. Send this episode to a friend who might be ready to fall in love with a new author. Every little share helps us bring some readers and authors together. Thanks again, Ruby, and thank you for being a part of the Reading Collective.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Hopefully, we maybe might have you another time, too.
Sure.
But to our listeners, happy reading, and may you always have a magical artifact that you need. Yay!
Probably not one that dispenses olives, right?
Yeah.
Unless you're really into olives.
Yeah, that's mine. That's mine, everybody. Sorry.
I'm like, I don't really like olives, so. That one's just torture. Or the one that does onions.
Oh my gosh, the onion one. That was so funny. Thanks, Ruby.
Absolutely.